Want to know more about what your favorite ninjas have on their minds? Check out the American Ninja Warrior podcast. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, and it's a great listen for any Ninja Warrior fan.
Everybody, welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenue's minor league podcast. I'm Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos this week. Lucas, how's it going?
All right. Extremely tired, but going to tough it out here.
All right. See, that's dedication, folks. Dedication. Mm-hmm. All right. So we'll do some quick promote extend trade here. And today in 1793... the cornerstone for one of the residence halls at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill was laid, and it's still being used today. So that makes it the oldest state university building in the United States. It's 226 years old. Mm-hmm. And the Mets have had a couple of players from UNC, most notably Matt Harvey, but also Ryder Ryan.
Yeah, because that's working out.
Yeah. But overall, there have been 271 players drafted from UNC. So of these non-Matt Harvey players, who would you promote, extend, or trade? First, there's Kyle Seager, who was drafted in the third round, 82nd overall, in the 2009 draft by the Mariners. Mm-hmm. Next, there's Andrew Miller, who was drafted in the first round, 6th overall, in the 2006 draft by the Tigers. And lastly is Chris Iannetta, who was drafted in the fourth round, 110th overall, in the 2004 draft by the Rockies. So who are we going to promote, extend, and trade?
I think Kyle Seager is probably one of the more underrated players of the last decade. He's been around longer than most people than I think.
Yeah,
he came up in 2011.
He's been around longer than I thought he was. But also I was thinking of his brother, so.
Yeah. I mean, the dude consistently has put up three or more wins. He's got 30 F4 in the last 8 years. Like, he's been a very good third baseman. I think he's the obvious extend. Even if he's not like the flashiest dude, and obviously not a Hall of Famer, but definitely into that like Hall of Very Good section. Mm-hmm. Probably. Miller's a tough one. I don't know quite what to do with him because he was so bad and then so good and seems to have now gone back to bad because of injuries. But like that elite reliever period was insane. So he should probably be the promote and then just trade Iannetta.
So you were talking about being underrated before by Seager. And I feel like it's the Iannetta is extremely underrated. He's a guy that didn't really hit for an impressive batting average, but consistently, you know, his on-base percentage was like 100 points higher than his batting average. And, you know, he was a catcher with long activity and solid numbers. I don't think his defense is really that great, so that kind of suppressed his WAR numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, catcher defense is kind of hard to quantify and everything, but I would extend him just because he's, you know, solid catchers are hard to find in baseball, and he's a kind of underrated solid catcher for a good decade or so for the Rockies, and I think also for the Angels.
He was with the Angels for
Texas.
4 or 5 years,
yeah.
And then bounced around. I think he made it back to Colorado the last 2 years as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yep. So I would extend him. I would promote Seager, and I would trade Miller, try to cash in on that draft pedigree or that elite reliever period that he had.
Trade him for Miguel Cabrera. That worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Iannetta is like the deep. I don't know how much I trust Baseball Prospectus's retroactive catcher defense numbers, but they're really not great for him. And the offensive numbers are, of course, biased by Coors, but you could do a lot worse at catcher.
Yeah, I mean, catcher is just a hard position to find anybody who's decent. Mm-hmm. And he has a decade or so of solid yet uninspiring numbers. And for a catcher, I would take that.
Right.
All right. We'll do an AFL update. Not too much action this week.
Mm-hmm.
All-Star game is actually tonight. The Mets have two players there, Andres Jimenez and Jordan Humphreys. But overall, Jimenez is doing good. In 12 games, he's currently batting .333, .400, .533, with four doubles, a triple, and a homer, and two stolen bases. So this is, you know, earlier when we were saying what we wanted to see from him, and this is exactly what, you know, we wanted to see. Hitting, mm-hmm. spraying doubles around, he's stealing bases. He has about a 2-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio, so that's fine. He's really the only one that's gotten much playing time this week. Everybody else has really just played in a game, so.
Yeah. Mishlag like only got like one game, right?
Yeah. Two, I think, but.
Okay. And I don't really care about Ollie Sanchez or.
I know. Just one game, yeah.
Carpio's still doing his, like, I walk and I can't hit for any power shtick, but it's just not a super exciting group of guys after Jimenez.
No, it wasn't really that much going on there.
Right. The walks are encouraging, though. Like, it's nice to see him get that on-base percentage up. I don't know. Perhaps, if nothing else from this swing change, he learns a little bit more patience. But I don't know. It still seems like the power isn't there. The strikeouts are up. So I wonder if they kind of roll things back a little bit.
The AFL, it's hard to judge. Obviously, small sample size, and then the environment is very biased towards hitting. So, mm-hmm.
who'd they play this week? Was it AFL teams or Mexican League teams? I didn't actually check.
It was all AFL teams. I don't know if that's going to be permanent from now on. I mean, we're almost at the end of the AFL here. It's starting to wind down, but
yep.
I don't know if they're going to be going back to playing Mexican League teams again, or if it was just like a one kind of weak thing.
Mm. Yeah. The stats,
but yeah,
the
that,
sample
that
size
further muddied the waters.
Yeah, the sample size is still small and the quality of the competition is still all over the place.
Yep, but he's, you want him to, you know, do well, and he is doing well, so
mm-hmm.
that's all that really matters.
It's kind of a catch-22, right? Like, you do bad, and it's bad. You do good, and it means nothing.
Yeah.
You can't win. You can only lose.
Nope. Oh. All right, so, you know, hopefully everybody continues.
Did Humphreys
liking
pitch this week or no?
No, he hasn't. He's pitching tonight in the All-Star game.
Yeah.
The only pitchers that went were Gilliam and Blake Taylor this week. They both threw in the inning and kind of kept doing what they've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Taylor put up a scoreless inning, and Gilliam gave up an unearned run. It's actually crazy. He has 6 unearned runs and then 1 earned run.
Mm-hmm.
He's allowing a lot of hits.
Yep. Yeah, it's not a super impressive line.
No. All right, well, hopefully everybody does better next week. Hopefully everyone plays more next week.
Yep. Hey, hopefully Jimenez launches 3 bombs in the All-Star game or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, who was it? It was Alonso last year. He hit that mammoth homer off of Nate Pearson. And I don't want to say that kind of put him on the board, but maybe to a national audience, that kind of put him on the board. But, you know, he was our number one prospect coming to the season. And obviously, Mets prospect circles were aware of him and everything. But maybe mm-hmm. Jimenez this year could have a coming out party as well.
Yeah,
probably not, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now let's switch gears and we'll talk about the Brooklyn Cyclones.
As I joked before the podcast, I'm unfortunately the one regular contributor that did not see the Cyclones this year. Like,
that's all right. I saw enough games.
Mm-hmm.
I think I went to 7 games for the Cyclones this year.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
I try to always go to the ones where they play Staten Island because it's like, you know, a 10-minute drive from me and
mm-hmm.
if I'm working like super early, you know, what's the latest the game's end is like, you know, 10:30, whatever. So I'm still in bed. Don't need to worry about that. And yeah, I went to a bunch of games in Coney Island. I don't know why, but
let's see. I think it's like a 2-hour train ride almost for me, which is a little unfortunate.
Oof, yeah, that's...
It's like people say you live in the city, you must be close to everything. No. I'm in the city, but I'm nowhere close. It's 1 hour and 40 minutes by train. That's brutal.
Yeesh. Yeah, I mean, when I take mass transportation, it takes me about 2 hours to get there. Mm-hmm. Gotta take the ferry, then take the train, and... Unfortunately, I don't like driving there, so...
Yeah, I mean, that's a really rough drive in terms of traffic.
All right, well, they were certainly worth seeing this year, because obviously they won the New York Penn Championship.
Hooray!
Yep, they went 42-32 in the regular season, and that was the best that they've been in years, because... Basically, after a decade plus of being a 500 or better team, in 2015, they were under 500 for the first time. And that kind of trend continued. They hit the low mark in 2017. They were historically bad, actually. They were 24-52, which was one of the worst records in New York Penn League history. But last year, they finally were over 500. They went 40-35 last year. And then this season, they were 42-32. And it was a fun season. There's a bunch of maybe not the highest upside players, but, you know, interesting names.
And it turns out when you start drafting seniors in, like, the fifth round, you get a couple interesting ones.
Yep, exactly. They faced Hudson Valley in the semifinals, and... It was a fun series. Michael Otañez, he lost the first game, but then Nate Jones and Matt Allen pitched the second game, and they kind of won it with a few no-hit innings. They actually had 7.1 no-hit innings. And that was the game that Jed Lowry hit a home run, and the final score is 1-0. Mm-hmm. And then the game three, it was kind of a back and forth game, and Ranfi Adan, who was really one of the worst hitters I've ever seen, like.
Tell us how you really feel about Ranfi Adan.
I'll preface this by saying, I mean, I'm not, you know, I've only really gotten into this minor league stuff the last couple of years and really going to a lot of games and everything, but he really is probably the worst hitter that I've seen. He just has a very weird swing. It's like he tries to inside out everything. Mm-hmm. It's odd looking. But he came through, like, in the clutch multiple times, and I think he hit, like, two doubles, and they were both the ones that were the difference makers, and that got Brooklyn into the finals, taking on the Lowell Spinners, which was Boston's team. And that was a team that had a bunch of like, legit prospects. But mm-hmm. being Boston system, you know,
Legit prospects and the worst system in baseball.
Yeah,
is there anyone worse than them at this point? Probably not.
One of the.
Yeah.
But Brooklyn took game one. Garrison Bryant, who was basically the best pitcher on the team all year, he threw 6 scoreless innings, and... The offense just got enough, and they won 2-1 in the first game. Second game, not so much. Brooklyn lost. They got shut down. And game three was a fun, very exciting nail biter. Later on in the podcast, I recorded a segment with my brother. We talk about that a little more since he was with me in that game, but. It was a tension filled night, but it was like good tension, you know, it was like the nervous, excited, fun kind. Mm-hmm. And in the end, Brooklyn came through, and it was nice to see a team that I root for, you know, win.
Right. Because the Mets certainly aren't doing it anytime soon.
Exactly. It was good seeing the championship trophy being lifted. I mean, I'm a Giants fan, so I got to see the couple of Super Bowls. But, you know, seeing, you know, obviously it was not there.
Right.
But being there in person, seeing them win, being in the crowd as, you know, Andrew Edwards threw the last pitch, you know, a swing and a miss, he struck him out, and just the collective euphoria from the crowd, it was just really fun.
I think baseball, I don't know, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. Like, every sport has a different playoff atmosphere. Like, hockey is definitely, or supposedly, the most frenetic. Like, it's just insanity the whole time, as long as it's close. But I feel like football and basketball usually don't have the kind of tense finishes that baseball does. I mean, it's just a function of how the sport works, but that, like, tension of impatience almost watching baseball playoffs is always satisfying. So, yeah, it must have been really cool to feel that in the stands as the game's closing out here.
In basketball, football, you can wait out the clock. In basketball, you can kind of stall to a degree when there's not that much time left on the clock. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, baseball, it's like, you know, there is no time, so you have to make that one pitch.
Right.
And anything could happen on that last pitch.
Right. Like, football just turns into a kneel-down fest. Basketball turns into a foul fest. So it's definitely a different kind of energy, but hockey and baseball probably have the most sort of playoff tension energy. So, that must have been pretty cool.
I'm trying to remember. I think it was 2017. I went with my family. We went on a road trip, me and my brother, my cousin, and my uncle. We went to Cleveland to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is what we were going to see originally. Mm-hmm. And then one night we were just kind of eating and my brother's like, hey, we should go to the Cavaliers game. It was, I don't know if it was the finals. It wasn't the finals. It was like the semifinals or the quarterfinals, whatever. They were playing, I think, Boston. So, and they won. I don't think it was a particularly close game. You know, it wasn't like a blowout either. But it was like a fun atmosphere to be in. But it was kind of just like, all right, whatever. Like, cool.
Right.
You know, also having no rooting is just, you know, really, it was like, all right, whatever. Like, rooting for the Cavaliers just because, like, that's the home team. I don't care about either one, so fine, I'll root for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, on the way home, we stopped off at Pittsburgh because we were going to, like, the Mets-Pittsburgh game. And while we were driving there, we were like, you know what? We got Cavalier tickets on the spur of the moment. Let's see if there are Penguin tickets available. And there were. And it was Game 7 of the semifinals, the Penguins versus the Canadiens. And that game was pretty crazy. It went into double overtime.
Mm-hmm.
And the Penguins won. They went to the Stanley Cup Finals. And I would say that the atmosphere of that game was similar to the atmosphere of the Cyclones game for the last, you know, inning or so. Obviously, at the beginning of the game, the beginning of the Cyclones game, you know, it's nervous excitement and whatever, but, you know, not frenetic, like you were saying, not, you know, too high, you know, the energy level. Because the game has to kind of start and get underway. Whereas hockey, you know, from the first play, everyone's going crazy. Mm-hmm. But in, like, the ninth, once the Cyclones took the lead in either the seventh or eighth, I forget, I think it was the eighth, the energy level for, like, every pitch was, like, up there. And it wasn't a huge crowd. I think they sold 2,000 tickets, and the crowd was probably about half that, so maybe about 1,000 people. Because it was just a random, you know, Tuesday night. But it was a great crowd, obviously a great game because they won. A very big, very different story if they lost.
Right.
But yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we get to watch the Mets do that at some point. You know, like.
Yeah. Not counting on that.
One can dream.
Yeah. Well, the. The Mets have a couple of Cyclone alumni on the team now, so maybe In the future, some of the Cyclone players that are on the team now will be Mets players and will bring some of that winning magic to Queens.
Hey, Noah Syndergaard contributed one inning to this championship season.
Right, exactly. So did Justin Wilson, I'm pretty sure. JV's Familia, you know.
Sorry, five innings for Syndergaard, so might as well give him a ring, you know.
PJ Conlon had a, had a 3.2 innings of shutout ball.
PJ Conlon still exists.
But yeah, some of the players on the Cyclones, most of them are probably just minor league filler, but some might go on to actually play in the major league club, and we'll talk about some of those guys right after this break.
Check out the American Ninja Warrior podcast for a behind-the-scenes look at all the action of the show and more with your favorite competitors. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Steve Saipa. This is from Complex to Queens, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos. And we're just going over the 2019 Brooklyn Cyclones, the New York Penn League champions. And, yeah, so a lot of guys from the draft this year. Obviously, I mean, that's always what happens. By and
Brooklyn
large,
must win.
The New York Penn League is usually full of, you know, college guys that get drafted during the year. So because of the Mets' strategy, yeah, Brooklyn had to win. There's a lot of high-ish upside. Well, of the seniors that were available in the draft this year, the Mets had the got to pick the cream of the crop, or what they identified as the cream of the crop anyway, because they were going for college seniors, you know, rounds 4+, when most other teams probably start dipping to that well like 7 or so. So the Mets had quite a head start. And they were able to draft guys like Jake Mangum, who, you know, they drafted last year. He chose to go back to school, but he was considered one of the best college players available. Antoine Duplantis was another one, a longtime performer in college. And a few, you know, solid contributors.
Luke Ritter, right? Unless I'm totally misremembering who they drafted this year.
Yeah, Luke Ritter was another one. He wasn't really on the radar of many. It was basically limited to Duplantis and Mangum as like the kind of college players that people were like, oh, okay, you know, these guys might be something in the future. But I mean, that, you know, was all very variable. But yeah, Luke Ritter was a big contributor to the team. He was drafted this year. Joe Genord, another big contributor to the team that was drafted this year. Who else? A few pitchers. Mitch Reagan was drafted this year. Andrew Edwards. Then that's really more or less it. I mean, a couple of Jared Biddy, a couple of guys, you know, were obviously drafted this year, but were not, you know, big contributors, but those are the main ones. But yeah, this team was a pretty good blend of guys that came up through the system. You know, like IFAs or younger, prep guys that were drafted a few years ago that are making their way up, and then guys that were drafted this year. The main pitchers on the team this year were Matt Cleveland and Garrison Bryant. They were both drafted out of high school in 2016. Neither one has, you know, extremely high upside, but they were like the backbone of the pitching staff. Michael Etanez, who we've talked about because of his fastball. He was an IFA a couple of years ago. A lot of the bullpen were guys that were IFAs. In terms of hitters, Wilmer Reyes, who was an IFA, he was the highest average batting average on the team. There's Yoel Romero. He was a very solid utility guy in the infield.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good mix.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. Like, there's a big mix of players on here, but I'm not sure how many real prospects were on this roster.
Really, I mean, there's Matt Allen.
Yeah, I mean, Matt Allen came up and looked really good, even if the ERA wasn't super pretty.
Yeah, I mean, him and Beatty kind of both got cameos at the end of the year, but, you know, they weren't really mainstays on the team. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Ritter in the past. I feel like he's kind of that gritty, scrappy, overlooked player that, you know, gets further than you think.
Right.
I don't know if he necessarily has major league upside, but I mean, I wouldn't write him off, you know, immediately.
Right.
And actually, it's interesting. I forget for what. I guess it was for MLB Prospect Pipeline. There was like a 4 or 5 minute video of basically Al Leiter, which was kind of talking about the Mets' top pitchers from the year. And then he was talking about just underrated guys that, you know, he liked. And Ritter was one of the guys that he liked. So
mm-hmm.
That's good to hear. I mean, he's obviously under the employ of the Mets, but
right.
He's also, you know, just a baseball guy. You know, he knows much more about baseball, much more to look for and everything than I do. So mm-hmm. If he likes Ritter, that's a good sign, I guess.
Got to pump up some pieces for Brody to trade this offseason, you know?
That is true, too.
Yeah. I mean, on the other end of that spectrum, like, you were talking about Duplantis and Mangum, who were both just bad. Like, really not good in terms of the stat lines they put up. Both of them had sluggings under 300. Duplantis had a on-base percentage under 300. Like, it doesn't really look like they have the hitting prowess to stick, right? Like, that's not great.
No, definitely is not great. You can always, though, give college performers a kind of a little bit of leeway in the New York Penn League once they get drafted, because they're coming off of a, you know, 80-game, or not really 80, more like a 60-game season in college,
mm-hmm.
and then they're playing a whole nother season in the New York Penn. So, you know, let's take Duplantis, because I have his stats right in front of me here. So if he played, you know, 70 games at where is he from? LSU?
I could not tell you.
Yeah, he's from LSU. So if he played 70 games at LSU and then another 50 with the Cyclones, that's basically double seasons. You know, he's never played that many games before. So it's understandable that he'd be tired and not really putting up what he is capable of doing in Brooklyn, especially with the stadium effects and everything at MSU.
Right, that's fair.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, he isn't a guy that has extremely high upside, especially as a hitter. Him and Mangum are kind of similar in that they're
lacking very, power.
Yeah, very. There's a lack of power, and it's more of emphasis on speed. You know, the kind of slap hitters that'll go the opposite way for doubles, and that's about it.
They're showing up to Major League Baseball, or I guess not Major League Baseball, affiliated baseball, like 30 years too late, almost.
Yeah. I mean, they played, they're both center fielders. Mangum is the better one. He is probably an average to above average center fielder.
mm-hmm.
So he has that going for him. Duplantis, didn't really get to see him in center too much because he was supplanted by Mangum, but he had a reputation for being a solid center fielder, so that's always good.
Right. I mean, the only way I could see either of these guys making a major league roster is like as a designated steal a base guy on a playoff team, but I'm not even sure they have that level of speed. Like, they're not Billy Hamilton. They're fast, but they're not that fast.
Oh, yeah. Well, nobody is that fast.
That's fair, right? Who's a more realistic example?
Dyson.
Who was the guy that the Royals always added, like Gore or whatever?
Yeah, Terrence Gore.
Yeah. Perhaps that's a more realistic comparison.
Yeah, and, you know, it's an approach thing for both of them. So maybe with professional coaching, if they learn to kind of use more, you know, pull the ball more.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of get away from what they were doing in school, just kind of going the opposite field for doubles and legging them out. You know, maybe there'll be some power boosts,
mm-hmm.
especially if they get to AAA and they start using that ball.
Right. I mean, anyone can hit a bomb with the AAA baseball this year.
Right. He'll go from slugging 297 to slugging, you know, 792.
That might be a little ambitious. Let's see Joe Gennord with the AAA ball.
Yeah.
Hit balls to the moon.
He could. It's not an easy feat to hit home runs at MSU Park, and he hit 9, which is among the most not the most in Cyclones history, but I think it was the fifth most, sixth
Is it about that park? That, is it just really big, or is it the wind coming off the water that makes it rough for home run hitters?
That's the wind. It's basically, if you are a left-hander, there's no...
No way?
No way.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
And also, again, like I was saying about, you know, the amount of games that these guys are playing, that's going to be more detrimental for hitters and everyday players than it is going to be for pitchers who, you know, aren't going every day. So the quality of pitching is a bit better in the New York Penn than the quality of hitters.
Right. Even the pitchers, they're not even going every day, and they're also not doing long outings, right? They're doing like 3 or 4 innings most of the time, it seems. Like, nobody throws a 7-inning start.
Sometimes, but yeah, by and large, you know, you're getting guys that are 5-6 at most. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, you know, if a guy's doing really good, he'll get more, but it's, a combination of it's a developmental league, it's a short season league of guys coming from, you know, college, they're tired and everything, but yeah, very rare do you see dominant kind of pitching performances like that.
Right. I mean, should we talk about some of the pitchers now that we that might be a good segue there?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, do you think Bryant's legit, or is he just a guy shoving against inferior competition?
It's questionable. He doesn't have great stuff. I think that his best attribute is his durability, I guess. He led the team in innings pitched, 75.1, which is pretty solid for the New York Penn. Obviously, in years past, he didn't put up numbers like this. But, you know, he was working on his stuff. The kind of his fastball isn't that great. It's about 87 and 91, which is not optimal. Has a little bit of movement, but he's been working on his secondary stuff. He was kind of throwing like a loose breaking ball that was like halfway between a curveball and a slider. And this season, or over the last winter, it kind of developed into more of a slider. So, you know, the development of his pitch there may be the reason why he was so good this year. But even still, you know, a below average fastball and an okay slider and you know, an okay curveball that he's also throwing.
Mm-hmm.
Not a recipe for success, you know, in Columbia or going forward.
That's not particularly encouraging.
No, but, you know, he's still is only 20, so if he adds another mile to his fastball over the winter, which is theoretically possible, then he's, you know, sitting in the low 90s, you know, 90 to 93 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still not great, but it's at that point, you know, it's workable, it's doable. I mean, a guy like Harold Gonzalez, he's thrived now in Double A and Triple A with a fastball that's about that.
Harold Gonzalez, Mets 7th, 8th starter.
I would like to see him get at least a major league start.
I mean, let's be realistic. Do we think the Mets are going to add any legitimate starting pitching depth? No, they're not. Harold's getting major league time next year. It's going to be probably bad, but also great.
Just, it'll be like a moral victory, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Get your, like, 40 days on the roster and collect that MLB pension.
Yep. And we've been beating that Harold drum for years now, so it'll be validation if nothing else.
I think Jeff's Twitter might actually combust for a week or two.
if the opposing pitcher is petite, then
oh god,
we'll just delete his Twitter.
Yep. Or actually, no, I think I'd almost prefer it to be like Sixto Sanchez or something, so it's like the two polar opposites of pitching archetypes, but both very much Jeff's guys, be entertaining.
Flamethrower versus the finesser.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the kind of the answer we expected on Bryant, but even beyond him, there's no pitchers to talk about on this roster that are... Like, yeah. Otani just throws hard, but that's about it.
Yeah, he throws hard, but that's about it. Cleveland throws a little less hard, but same thing, same problem. He just doesn't know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
He probably has the worst command of any pitcher that I've seen.
Again, that's concerning.
Yeah, we're talking about Ranfi Adon is the worst hitter I've ever seen. Cleveland has the worst command of the fastball that I've ever seen. Like, I've seen guys bounce the curveball, bounce the changeup too low, whatever, but he was bouncing a fastball, which is not good.
I feel like the only pitcher I've ever seen bounce a fastball is Familia, and he at least doesn't do it consistently. It just happens sometimes.
Right, like his has so much sink on it that it just, you know. But Cleveland, yeah, no. And he was a guy, you know, who was kind of a little bit of hype when he was drafted, you know, a prep guy.
Right.
2016, but no, the development has not really occurred.
Was he the same year as Plonk? Is that the same class, or am I misremembering that? I might be off. Maybe Plonk was the year before. Point is, the Mets have picked up a couple of these like lower end prep guys, and almost none of them have worked out.
No.
So Bucky is probably the biggest success, and he's I don't know what he is at this point.
No one knows.
Yeah. No one else on this roster is worth... I mean, Allen kind of shoved in his brief time, I think. Like, he looked really good. The stuff looks really good, but it's only a couple innings.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, him and Beatty kind of had some cameos, and we know that they are a cut above everybody else on the roster.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to, like, have them, you know, talk about them in the same breath than it is as everybody else.
Right. Plus, they also have that draft year effect. So, I mean, we definitely know Beatty was tired by the end.
Yeah.
Is Jason Acosta one guy you've talked about in the past, or am I misremembering that?
Yes, he's a guy I liked. Mm-hmm. He had a couple of innings in Brooklyn. They promoted him to Columbia pretty quickly, and he stunk up the joint at the beginning of his time there, but he kind of got better as the year went on. He ended up putting a 3.78 ERA in 52 innings there, which is okay. Mm-hmm. He walked a few more batters than would have liked. He had a PB per nine rate of 4.5, which is a bit high, and his strikeout per nine was 8.4, so that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But he's only 20, so it's still a little young for Columbia. That's kind of the track that you want to put, like, your prospect pitchers on. So he fared well there.
Right. So he's moved past Brooklyn at this point.
Yeah. he got, let's see, he had 18 innings in Brooklyn.
Right. Yeah.
Three starts, just, 4 appearances.
It's just really thin pickings, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. Andrew Edwards, he's a left-hander. He was drafted this year. He pitched, he threw the final inning of the championship game. He might be, if something. They exist, if they exist in a couple of years, a loogie. I mean, I don't know.
Oh, right. Is that one batter thing starting next year?
Yeah, I'm not sure when it's starting, but mm-hmm. obviously the ramifications of is going to be pretty big on bullpen composition.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, you know, he's a solid, if unspectacular, left-hander, but, you know, he has the lowish arm slot, so, and an okay slider or changeup, I forget off the top of my head, but it was effective.
Right.
But, yeah, it's slim pickings.
And Edwards is definitely old for the level. Like, he was 22.
Yeah, he was
a... Shit, he has the same birthday as I do. That's kind of funny.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. I mean, let's see what he does as a reliever, presumably a level or two higher next year.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they make up rosters next year because
mm-hmm.
all of the – between – you know, there are guys in the GCL that could have been on Kingsport or Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. There are guys in Kingsport that could have been in the GCL or Brooklyn, and there are guys in Brooklyn that could have been in, you know, Columbia if you pushed them hard enough. So
right.
A lot because, again, of that strategy where they were picking a lot of older guys. So,
yeah, not that I'm complaining about that because they pulled it off and got Allen, Wolf, and Beatty. But I do wonder what having all these seniors do or what it does to your development pipeline. Does it kind of clog things up for the more legitimate prospects? I don't know. We'll see how it works out next year.
Yeah, somebody asked me on Twitter, I think, like a couple of days ago, because I wrote an article about the strategy that they used and how the players that they picked in this draft this year didn't really perform any better or worse than all the guys that they picked, you know, in years, couple of years. And yeah, one thing that I mentioned was that I'm not really sure how, like, obviously Allen, Wolf, and Beatty, three, you know, very high upside guys, but I'm not really sure if this kind of strategy is good for the system's health as a whole,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I don't know, like, I guess I'm kind of being biased to a degree against these guys because, you know, okay, well, they're seniors, so they're automatically gonna amount to nothing and flame out early.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just the Mets have had problems, you know, even in the mid minors in, you know, St. Lucie and Binghamton, filling, you know, roles, bench guys, things like that, because of attrition lower down in the system, and they're having to dip into like the minor league free agent pool and the indies and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So if, you know, assuming that a lot of these guys don't make it to, you know, high A or double A because they're college seniors and their upside is more limited, you know, that's just going to exacerbate the problem that the Mets are already having.
See, I do wonder, I mean, I understand your point there. For the moment, I think I'm still heavily in favor of it because you got the guys with higher upside, and usually in rounds 4 through 10, most teams aren't getting much out of it anyway. Like, I'm sure someone has done the numbers on this, but how many guys drafted in the 4th to 10th round typically make the majors at all? I imagine it's something like 1% or fewer of the draftees.
No, even fewer.
Yeah. So like,
I don't know. Give you an exact answer right now.
Yeah. So, but my point is like, that concern seems real, and maybe in a couple years we'll be singing a different tune. But for now, I think it's fine. What they did was probably the correct move.
Yeah, that's it. In the 4th round, and well, shout out to Amazing Avenue commenter C-Pins for doing this research here. But in 2010, so he was picking a couple of drafts ago, the 4th round, it was Sam Dyson, Eddie Rosario, James Paxton. They're the only three of the 30 players in the 4th round that have more than to war.
Mm-hmm.
In the fifth round, there was Matt Dendecker, Heath Hembre, and Tommy Kalmy. In the sixth round, there was Scott Alexander, Adam Plutko, and Brian Halliday.
So, catcher for the Tigers?
I guess. I don't even know who he is.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that's who that is.
But, yeah, there's you can count on basically one hand all of the guys that have posted positive war in round four or five, six, you know, for a draft going almost 10 years now.
Not that I ever want to defend a team for not spending money either on the resources to scout or the resources to sign guys, but it almost feels like you could just throw darts and sign cheap guys from round 4 to 10 and not see significantly reduced results.
Yeah, I mean, that is where your actual scouts and your analytics people come into play now, because, you know, if you're, you know, identifying guys, you want to make sure that you're identifying the right guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't seem like anybody is doing a good job of identifying the right guys.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we'll see. In terms of this draft class anyway, in a couple of years.
Except like the Dodgers, who turned Matt Beattie and the corpse of Max Muncy into above average hitters or whatever. But
yeah, well, they're a team to want to emulate. They spend a lot of money. They draft well. They do everything good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Except their crime spreadsheet.
Right. That's you don't want to have one of those. And unfortunately, they do.
Lessons from the Dodgers. Spending on draft resources, good. Tracking all your crimes in an easily accessible Google Drive, not so good.
Yeah, not a good idea. Welcome back, everybody. This is From Complex to Queens, the Mason Avenue's minor league podcast, and I'm Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by a new guest this week. My brother, Michael
what
Saipa.
What up? Michael Saipa.
How's it going, Mike?
I'm living. We're champions, so I'm living well.
Exactly. Well, we weren't able to talk too much about Kingsport last week, but going forward, I want to start touching on just kind of like some extraneous stuff about each, you know, affiliate and team that we're going to be talking about. And so, obviously, we're talking about Brooklyn, and you were with me. You've been to quite a few Cyclones games with me over the years.
Thanks for that. Yeah.
Yes, one of the perks of being a little brother.
Oh, yeah. Random. All the different trips we've taken?
Yep.
I wouldn't trade you in, don't worry.
Random texts just out of nowhere, like, hey, I got a ticket to the game, you want to come? Like,
God,
10 minutes before the game, you know, those kinds of things.
I think 5,000 different jerseys on every jersey night. We have Jersey Shore jerseys, like, what the hell?
But I still treasure.
They were good. They were actually good. Italian night was a really good one, too.
But you were with me. You came with me to the champion, what turned out to be the championship game when the Cyclones beat the Spinners and 3-4, and they became champions in the New York Penn League in 2019.
That's right. No more co-champions, no more maybe champions. Champions.
Yeah. Like, how would you, like I said, you've been to plenty of games with me. How would you describe, like, the crowd and just how it felt? Because to me, like, that was one of the most electrifying crowds, like, I've ever been in.
Yeah, you know, what's amazing is that there's always the argument of quality and quantity, right? And so we've been to a lot of games where there's been a lot of quantity, full stadiums, but not really any kind of enthusiasm, just like, hey, this is a game. But here, we got actual quality out of the fans. Between you and me screaming at stuff, and everyone around us screaming at stuff, and everyone starting claps and chants, it really felt like a live crowd. They made up for every seat that wasn't packed by being louder than they ever have been before. It was amazing.
Yeah. The ticket sold number was 2,050. I think you'll agree that definitely were less people there.
Yeah.
Probably half that. But it was a random Tuesday afternoon. Well, no, Tuesday evening. It was the day before 9/11. So, you know, people obviously stuff going on, even without the 9/11 involvement, just a random Tuesday night. So people.
It was a dreary day. Honestly, like,
Yeah.
wasn't for being a championship game, I don't know who would have wanted to go to a game that day, you know?
But yeah, it wasn't cold. It wasn't rainy, but it was just kind of gray and overcast.
And the wind was blowing in from the water because the Cyclones are right there. So, you know, it wasn't a day for baseball in any other way, but it was a day for championship baseball.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, what a game. You went down with me to Kingsport, and I think that you would agree that I don't want to make Kingsport look bad, but the crowds were not as lively.
Right. If I'm being honest, I don't think Kingsport deserves a bad rep because it just is what it is. And what it is tiny and underappreciated.
Yeah.
They're still a great team. They got the right development ideas. But I feel like their biggest fan is that one guy in the back going, "You go, Hector," every 5 minutes. And I love
him. It was, for anyone listening, that was legit a guy in the background at pretty much every single at bat that sounded like, sounded exactly like that. From
"You go, Brett."
Like a guy from King of the Hill.
Directly. We couldn't figure out which mix he was exactly, but he's definitely Dale with someone.
Yes.
Actually, that was kind of one difference between Brooklyn and the other divisions that is pretty direct, is that, like, the Brooklyn guy, you know, there were a bunch of Brooklyn guys at the Cyclones, mm-hmm. versus getting that real down home kind of feeling. It was different. The crowds actually give the players something at these minor league levels that you don't really get at the majors because they tell you to tune them out.
Yeah. I think that the minor league teams, I would say, definitely do draw from the hometown crowd. I mean, how can they not? They're still, you know, they're still young. They're still starry-eyed. A lot of them are very young. Matthew Allen was 18. Brett Beatty, 19.
Jesus.
You know, so.
They're all younger than me. Weird.
Yeah, you're getting to that age now.
Oh, God. I bet everyone listening feeling that. Oh, God.
But, yeah, it was just a very exciting game. For me, I think one of the reasons for that was that the end score was 4-3. So it wasn't like a pitching duel, but pitching really stood out for me on both sides. Like, for the Cyclones, Nate Jones, he was solid, opening for 3 innings. Matthew Allen, he pitched 3 innings, obviously really impressed. Like, the numbers, you know, he gave up, he struck out 2, didn't allow a hit, didn't allow a run over 3 innings. It's like, okay, this is a solid inning, a solid outing.
Yeah,
nothing really pops up at you in the box score. Mitch Reagan, he allowed a run, not good. And then, you know, the Cyclones got it back, obviously. And then Andrew Edwards in the end, pitching his 2 innings. I think, honestly, the most exciting of all those guys was Edwards in that last inning.
Yeah, he really shut it down. It was remarkable. When you got, like, Nate Jones and Matt Allen, they really put in a heavy performance. Though the 3 innings that each of them did, I got to give them a lot of credit. But Andrew Jones came in and just... He obliterated him. He made sure we won. He was going to hold that 4-3 lead no matter what.
Yeah, I was nervous when Lowell put in the last pitcher, Padron Ortiz. He was like mowing the Cyclones down. He was in his 5 innings of relief, which is basically a whole start, really. The start that he had made prior to this one, he struck out like 13 consecutive batters in their playoff game before this one.
Oh.
So he was like mowing the Cyclones down, and I was just like, oh God, like this guy is just going to shut them down, and all it's going to take is a run, which Lowell did get. But then luckily, you know, the Cyclones were able to come through.
Yeah, but big shout out to the outfield on that one. We had our left fielder Antoine with 2 hits and 2 RBIs, and our center fielder Jake with 2 hits and an RBI. That worked mm-hmm. out. Good for them.
Yeah, they are, you know, big college guys, big college performers. maybe not the highest upside guys, but this is like right in their wheelhouse. You know, the New York Penn League is not that much off from like NCAA Division One competition. So these are still guys that, regardless of what their ultimate future is, are at this level going to be reliable producers, and they came through. And that was just exciting, like, you know, when the tying run crossed the plate and the whole team, you know, they weren't waiting in the dugout for him. Like, they came out, they were bashing him on the head, they were giving him pats on the butt, everything.
Yeah, the whole night.
And then right. When the eventual winning run crossed the plate and they were, you know, all over him, and that just shows again how the excitement that the team is feeling.
Yeah, yeah, sometimes you get a certain sense of apathy out of these teams, so, especially when we went down south. Like, there's a little bit of a, all right, just another game. But the championship really brought it out of them. They really wanted it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could see teams where just, like, you know, you're in game 9 of a 10-game road series and you're just not into it. But everybody, the fans, the players, the coaches, everybody was into it. And same thing with Lowell. Obviously, when they took the lead, they were all out there. They were chirping at the umpires. They were chirping at the other team, everybody.
I remember distinctly, I can't remember the player's name, but I remember that there was this one guy, he was pretty husky, first baseman, and he just kept wailing the ball. He was desperate to be the hero. He wanted it so bad.
Joe Davis.
That guy was trying to win everything for his team. He hit blind drives that if they were fair, we all would have been in awe.
Yeah, that was every single time he came to the plate, it was, you know, made me nervous.
Yeah.
He walked off in their prior series to get them to the championship.
Wow.
So he was definitely trying to do that again in the deciding game 3 in this one.
And he gave it the ride. I remember our left fielder Antoine, actually, I don't know if he had to lay out for it specifically, but he made a great running catch to rob him because he just kept these line drives all the way deep. I actually have to give a quick shout out to the water for pushing the ball in. That air blowing in kept him in the stadium.
Yeah, the first, I think it was his first at bat, he hit like a massive foul ball.
Yeah.
And then I think he hit another one that got caught like at the wall.
Right.
And then he did hit a double that was off the wall.
Oh, look at that. He did get
far in the outfield, yeah.
Wow. But, you know, that's also a shout out to our pitching then, because they were able to somehow keep that guy in. Gotta give him credit. Especially Andrew Edwards, because he didn't allow anybody to do anything.
Yeah, you know, like I was saying before, like everybody, you know, Jones did, it was a solid start, and Matthew Allen is obviously the, you know, star prospect, and it's cool that the Mets were trusting of him enough to even let him throw innings in this. But Edwards really, like the last inning, he allowed a base runner, and then he just kind of locked things down, and, you know, I want to say that he threw like 9 pitches and got 3 strikes. I don't remember off the top of my head, but that's how it felt like.
I'm pretty sure you're right. Like, he had 1 walk and then struck the next 3 out. It was
like he just dug down and he was just like, nope, this is not happening on my watch.
Right. And it was great to watch, especially now that I know he also pitched the previous games. Like, he was tired, but still giving it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because this is the same team that's had guys like Pete Alonso, Brandon Nimmo, Michael Conforto. They've had some names pass through, but this time around, the only real name I think we could consider is maybe Matthew Allen and Brett Beatty, right?
Yeah, they are definitely the marquee guys here.
And, I mean, Matthew Allen for sure showed up because the 3 innings, no runs was remarkable. Beatty drew a walk and otherwise was just like a presence. He didn't necessarily do anything, but he contributed to that energy. Him being there was clearly a positive for everybody else, even, no matter how it went down on the field.
Yeah, he was similar, even though the performance wasn't there. I put him in a similar vein as Davis, the guy in Lowell. Like, you knew with one swing, Beatty could change the game, you know?
Absolutely. That's a great comparison. It felt exactly like that. But Beatty had that kind of patience that I didn't see when we were down south. But when he came up, I guess that was the trick for him. He figured out that, let me wait, let me see them actually give me my pitch now. And then they did, and here you go.
Well, when we found out after the fact that, or during the fact, maybe, I forget exactly when, that they were working with Beatty to just kind of have him hit to the opposite field and go back up the middle and just kind of learn to use the entire field. So, you know, maybe some of that, you know, was helping at this point now, because he only played in 4 games with Brooklyn, but he drew 6 walks, which is, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So, you know, with the power that he has, you know, pair that with a good eye, and that's like an Adam Dunn-ish kind of player, you know.
Right. I feel, you know, as much as Adam Dunn is kind of like a trope, he's a wonderful trope. He embodies what the game has become entirely. So,
yeah, how many home runs do you think Adam Dunn could hit with his juiced ball?
Oh, God.
Because he was a guy.
There's got to be players like Adam Dunn that are sitting at home going, damn it.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Just held on 1 to 2 more years.
Yeah, he did go way too long, too. You're right. But, I mean, I'm sure that all the, like, for example, let's get real crazy for a second. What would Hank Aaron and Babe Ruth be doing right now? You know? Like, holy crap.
Yeah, well.
But anyway, so one thing I got to say, too, I was kind of interested at how we were facing Boston, but it didn't really matter. Like, New York showed up for New York. It wasn't even about the competition. And I appreciate that. Like, we love our teams. We really do. I remember when the Brooklyn Cyclones, I was a little too young for their, like, inaugural year, but I just remember how they immediately mattered. We all cared about them so quickly. They always get the most attendance every year. Am I right?
I'm pretty sure that they're 19 straight seasons now.
Whew.
They've led the league in attendance. Let's see. How many?
Brooklyn loves its baseball.
Yeah, they do.
Their true thing. Hell, I'm from Queens. You're from Staten Island. We went far, and we still needed to be there. It's just that feeling, that draw. It's like baseball mecca. Brooklyn matters to baseball. It really does.
Mm-hmm. It's the truth. I have a quote. I wrote something about that a couple of days ago. And I have a quote from P.V. Reese, who obviously was a Brooklyn Dodger back in the golden era of baseball with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And the quote is, Brooklyn is the most wonderful city a man could play in, and the fans there were the most loyal there were.
He is so right.
That's still true.
You know, I mean, at one point they were the Brooklyn Bums, right? So, I mean, keep that in mind.
That's, you know, 1950, I'm going to say that. I don't know the exact date of the quote, but obviously he played from like 45, 46, whatever, to 50-something. So
yeah, that's a real career guy there. He played a lot of years.
So you know that you know, it's a quote that's over 50, 70 years old, but it still is true. You know, the people of Brooklyn may have changed, the racial complexion may have changed, the economics may have changed, but at the end of the day, it's a baseball town.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know what was good is that I did see that kind of transitioned to the younger generations, too. You're not just talking about a bunch of 50-year-old dudes in the crowd. There were some kids. There were some adults. It was a complete mix of all the races. There was a group of Hispanic kids right in front of us that I was talking to. And then right behind us were a bunch of old Italian guys. And then to the next of us, it was just all sorts of people. Brooklyn, as the city's become what it's become over these few years, this has never changed. And at this point, maybe it never will. And that's a great thing to think about. Now that we're champions, not co-champions, but champions, we can kind of keep that pedigree going. We can give them something to talk about for the next few years.
They've always had a competitive team. There was a couple of years in the mid-2010s, like I want to say 2016 through 18 or 15 through 17, whatever, where they were not winning and they were under 500. But aside from that, they've always had a team that was a 500 or better because – you know, it is Brooklyn. The Mets kind of do make it a point to send important players there at the end of the year or throughout the year to either, you know, if they're younger players, to just kind of stop in and experience what baseball is like in a big city. You know, you have your Noah Syndergaards who played on the Cyclones, Pete Alonso, you know, Conforto, important players that now are with the Mets have been Cyclones.
Right.
You'll have guys that'll do their rehab in Brooklyn. You'll have, you know, I've seen Syndergaard do rehab. I've seen Jose Reyes do rehab there.
Right.
I've seen Jason Vargas do his rehab here.
How many times?
Just once. But, you know, Syndergaard, Reyes, and Vargas. Which one does not belong? Which is not like the others?
I even remember David Wright doing a stint there once because it gives them the opportunity to have them close to home.
Right, exactly. You could have them, you know, you could have, like, the actual top management actually have, you know, physically be there and see them.
Right. That's true. I don't know if any other teams really have that same ability to say that. Like, oh, they're just an hour away. Let's go get them.
probably the Staten Island Yankees, but just, you know, I don't pay, obviously not a Yankee fan, so yeah, I don't really pay as much
Yankees
attention.
Yankees aren't going from, they don't care about what's happening at Staten Island, let's be
honest. Yeah, I want to say that a lot more guys do their rehab in Trenton than they do in the Staten Island Yankees.
That's right. I remember we saw a bunch of their Porsches out there when we went to go see their games.
Yeah, with the ginger guy. I forgot his name.
Clint Frazier, was it?
Clint Frazier, yeah, his Corvette or whatever that was.
Damn Corvette.
Parked on the grass.
Him and his success,
But Brooklyn is, it's just, the Mets do a good job of making the Cyclones relevant. And the location obviously helps. And it's, like you were saying, it's, minor league baseball is definitely more like family friendly, and the Cyclones do a good job at that. You know, it's a good environment for.
Yeah, I mean, you know, think about it for a second. They've got two different mascots, right? We've got Sandy the Seagull and Pee-wee. They've got the draw of Coney Island itself and this coaster. The coaster's worked into their stadium board. Like, that's also their mascot unofficially. And then they have the cheerleaders and the King. They really dedicate themselves to that. King Henry. I mean, I'm sorry I shouted you out, King Henry, but just saying. Like, they try. They have all sorts of pull for, like, oh, kids, look at Pee-wee. Kids, listen to King Henry, you know? Mm-hmm. Cheerleaders everywhere.
Yeah, and then, I mean, other teams do that. But I think, like you're saying, like, for the Cyclones, it's just built in better just because of the environment. You can... Right. Take your family and go to the beach during the day and then in the afternoon go to the game. Or you can go to an amusement park and then in the afternoon go to the game. Or
go to the aquarium.
Go to the aquarium, exactly, go to the game. Or go a little early and go to Nathan's. Or go to Spumoni Gardens, get a pizza. Or go to Roland Roaster in Cheapside Bay and get some roast beef and then come back to Coney Island and see the game.
I still got to do that one with you. I've snuck Nathan's in a bunch of times, but I can't wait to go to Roland Roaster.
it's the being in a metro area is definitely a big plus. You know, Kingsport, the stadium was kind of behind Home Depot, you know.
Quite literally behind Home Depot.
there was the Sonics, though, which I appreciate. I'd never gone to Sonics before and I did like it, so I'll give him props for that. But
yeah.
Look
not
at like
sponsored, but would be sponsored because I love Sonics.
Yeah. But like look at Trenton. Like it's a great stadium. Like the location is nice, but like there's nothing else really to do there. So you're just going for the game.
Right. And the thing is that it's nice to have the passion for the game like we do because we did go there just for the game, right? But having that excess, having all these extra little things to say, nah, all right, but come here for this, and baseball. It can't hurt. It's beautiful. I wish the Staten Island Yankees tried that kind of thing, but apparently the Yankees are too corrupt for that. They can't even put a Ferris wheel in.
Well, that's not their fault. That's the city of New York.
Hey,
but
it's their fault.
That's fine with me. Blame them for everything. They're the Yankees. I don't mind that.
Exactly. not you, but just saying.
Yeah, but overall, it was just a fun game and a really fun season with the Cyclones.
Yeah, I can't wait for next year. This is one of those things that I feel like they could really build on because some of that team is going to be the same next year, right?
Not really.
There's
sometime occasionally is some holdovers, but majority of the team will go on to Columbia next season. you generally don't want to see guys that in the minor leagues, you generally don't want to see guys that repeat because that means that they're not developing.
Well, that's true, but I was thinking more along the lines of like they got to go somewhere, you know?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of seniors that got drafted this year, so I mean, this could be some guys that repeat again, but odds are majority of the faces are going to be new next season. But
and you know what? It'll be good to see if the new guys can fill the shoes of the old guys because we're talking about champions now.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, we saw Kingsport. Some of the guys are probably going to skip over Brooklyn and go straight to Columbia. But some of the guys are probably going to go to Brooklyn. And there were some pretty talented guys in Kingsport. So hopefully they keep it up next year in Coney Island.
And that one guy will be around to say, "You go, Joe."
We should bring him up. He deserves it.
Let's call him up.
All right. Well, do you have anything to plug before we go here?
Let's go Mets. That's the only plug that matters here. Let's get this next year. We've got the team. We've got the pieces. Next year, Mets year. I called it here right now.
All right. That's a good plug. All right, well, everybody, thanks for listening to our little side trip here about Brooklyn. I'm Steve Sipa, obviously, and this is Michael Sipa, my brother, my partner for pretty much all the stuff that we've gone to this year was you and me, man.
I hold the radar gun.
He does. And doesn't use it well all the time and forgets.
I get half the pitches.
Half the pitches, yeah.
You can thank me later, guys.
All right. Well, we will be back after this. All right, so any last words for this week?
Did we talk about anybody on the Brooklyn coaching staff that might realistically be a managerial candidate? I don't think so, right?
Oh, no, we did not. Not right now. For this season. Obviously, Fonzie is the manager.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have Andy Chavez as a bench coach.
Andy.
Fan favorites, all teams, you know, there's weaknesses, obviously, for hiring fan favorites and all that stuff. But neither one of them have enough experience to slot into the Mets manager role right now.
How weird would a Carlos Beltran manager, Andy Chavez bench coach situation feel? First of all, it's a terrible idea. If you're going to hire a first-time manager, hire an experienced bench coach. But that'd be kind of trippy to watch. It'd be entertaining.
It would make me feel really, really old.
Oh, yeah. 2006 callbacks.
Mm-hmm.
They can lose in the NLCS to the Cardinals again. It'll be great. Painful.
Only after Andy Chavez makes an amazing call from the bench, though. He'll make an amazing defensive... what the hell's the word?
Repositions J.D.
Right,
Davis.
Right. He'll call for an amazing defensive repositioning.
Uh-huh. What are the Vegas odds on that? Low,
yeah. All right, well, if anyone has any comments, concerns, questions, all that, you can send us an email at our email address, fromcomplextoqueens@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at Steve Sipa, and Lucas is at lvlahost343. Subscribe to the podcast, rate our podcast, review it, leave comments about it, whatever you want to do. But thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. And until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.